As you probably all know, each week I try to pick out congregational songs that are directly related to the text I'm preaching from on that particular Sunday. And the words of Jesus we're going to be reading this morning warn about adultery, lust, and divorce. And our hymnal doesn't really contain a lot of songs about that. And so what I decided to do was to see if I could find hymns that were traditionally sung at weddings. And so I had to search online to find what hymns that might be. And in doing so, I came across a couple lists of wedding hymns that had one particular song high on their list. And this is the opening line of that song. Be still, my soul. The Lord is on thy side. Bear patiently the cross of grief or pain. Oh, boy, that's a happy song to sing at a wedding. Just sets the right tone for everything from there. But as we probably all recognize, there is a problem with marriage in America today. It remains a major battleground in the so-called culture wars. And tracing the beginning of this battle is not easy to do. But quite a few Americans identify 1969 as a crucial year in that battle. Not because that was the year that Neil Armstrong landed on the moon, or because that was the summer that 400,000 young people gathered at Woodstock. Rather, 1969 is important because that is the year that Governor Ronald Reagan of California signed legislation which made California the first state in America to permit no-fault divorce. So before that time, any legal divorce required one party show the other was at fault for basically bringing severe damage to the marriage. They had to prove that somebody had wronged somebody, so the marriage should therefore be broken. And that no-fault divorce was a major milestone in the history of marriage. But the law in California was a fruit of a mindset which had begun growing in America several decades earlier. So the evidence can be traced back at least as far as the 1920s that shows the institution of marriage was beginning to crumble. So that during the 1800s and even the first 10 to 20 years of the 1900s, the divorce rates in America were very, very low. Those divorce rates doubled in the 20s and then surged upwards again in the 1960s. By the early 1980s, they had reached their peak, and then after a few years actually began to drop down again, so that for the last 20 to 30 years or so, divorce rates have remained fairly steady in America. But I think we'd all recognize divorce is still far too common in our nation. And as we work through this particular passage today, I recognize that some in this congregation have been divorced. And my desire this morning is not to make you feel guilty for being divorced. It actually is not particularly a message about divorce, so that's part of it. I know some of you have biblical grounds for your divorce. Some of you were divorced against your will. Some of you were divorced before your salvation. But regardless of the reasons for the divorce, I don't want you to sit here this morning filled with guilt over the past. Now, if you do need to make things right with the former spouse, apply the principles that we looked at last week. Go make things right with them. And I don't know as well, though, that you probably none of you are able to go back to the past. You can't undo what has been done. There's probably no option for remarriage or anything of that nature. And that's not what I'm suggesting or going to suggest today. So I want you to know right up front, I'm not intending and I don't intend to bring a heavy weight of guilt on the fact that maybe you've been divorced. Rather, my desire, my goal this morning is to challenge each of us, whether married, single, widowed, divorced, to have a heart which honors marriage and pursues purity. And so before I go any farther, let me read verses 27 through 32. Jesus is speaking. He says, "You have heard that it was said to those of old, 'You shall not commit adultery.' But I say to you that whoever looks at a woman to lust for her has already committed adultery with her in his heart. If your right eye causes you to sin, pluck it out and cast it from you. For it is more profitable for you that one of your members perish than for your whole body to be cast into hell. And if your right hand causes you to sin, cut it off and cast it from you. For it is more profitable for you that one of your members perish than for your whole body to be cast into hell. Furthermore, it has been said, 'Whoever divorces his wife, let him give her a certificate of divorce.' But I say to you that whoever divorces his wife for any reason except sexual immorality causes her to commit adultery. And whoever marries a woman who is divorced commits adultery." The problem with marriage in America is not permissive divorce laws. The problem with marriage in America is not the 2015 Supreme Court decision to legalize homosexual marriage. The problem with marriage in America is not the promotion of homosexuality on TV and in movies and everywhere else, seemingly. And the problem with marriage in America is not even an internet that is drowning in pornography. The problem with marriage in America is not young couples waiting longer to get married or young men playing video games in their mother's basement until they're in their 30s. The problem with marriage is not the number of couples who are living together without being married. Now, all of these things may be threats to biblical marriage, but they are not, either individually or collectively, the problem. The problem threatening marriage is a nation of individuals who have no heart for purity or faithfulness. The problem in marriage today is a heart problem. And in this section on the Sermon on the Mount, Jesus is continuing to show the impossibility of being righteous enough to enter heaven. We can't lose sight of that. He started off and said, "Except your righteousness exceeds the righteousness of the scribes and the Pharisees, you shall not see heaven." And he ends it by saying, "Be ye therefore perfect, even as your Father which is in heaven is perfect." This entire section is about what is necessary to enter heaven. And the short answer is, what is necessary, you ain't got. You need somebody else to give it to you. In the midst of that, though, Jesus is also teaching a number of essential principles of how his disciples should view life and how they should be living. And so in this particular section, Jesus is showing the self-righteous that no one can possibly be good enough to get to heaven. So somebody might come along and say, "I'm a good person. I have never committed murder," the first example Jesus used. "And I've never cheated on my wife." And Jesus says, that's not good enough. If you hope to live a life good enough to get you out of eternal judgment, then you must live without lust, which is impossible, especially when you add it in with all the other things he says in this section. And the impossibility is the point. You must instead turn to Him for perfect righteousness. You must not pursue your own righteousness by your own efforts. And so that's what Jesus is doing. And I mention that because we must have that immediate context. But I'm going to move from that. And I want to talk specifically this morning about these principles that Jesus lays out. And they start in Genesis 2. Genesis 2 tells us of God's creation of marriage. God made Adam and showed him that none of the animals that God had already created were a suitable companion and helper for him. Then God made Adam a mate. He took one of Adam's ribs and formed Eve. That showed that though Eve was separate from Adam, she was still a part of him. And Adam woke up and exclaimed, "This is now bone of my bones and flesh of my flesh. She shall be called woman because she was taken out of man." And then the very next verse, Genesis 2:24, makes it apparent that the creation of Eve was also the creation of marriage. And it shows that the creation of Eve, the marriage of Adam and Eve, is the blueprint and the foundation of all other marriages. So Genesis 2:24 says, "Therefore, a man shall leave his father and mother and be joined to his wife, and they shall become one flesh." So that the creation of Adam and Eve, the marriage of Adam and Eve in the Garden of Eden, is the standard for marriage in every culture, in every era, forever afterwards. So Adam and Eve were husband and wife joined together by God. And every subsequent marriage is also a joining together of two people into one flesh by God. And Jesus says in Mark chapter 10, he says, "But from the beginning of the creation, God made them male and female." And then he quotes Genesis 2, "For this reason, a man shall leave his father and mother and be joined to his wife, and the two shall become one flesh. So then," and this is now Jesus adding to Genesis, "so then they are no longer two, but one flesh. Therefore, what God has joined together, let not man separate." And Jesus is declaring that the original marriage in the Garden of Eden is the blueprint for every later marriage, because it is God who unites the two into one. No one should seek to sever what God has joined. And though Jesus does not specifically mention Genesis 2 and creation of marriage in the Sermon on the Mount, we do need to understand what he is saying in these verses in light of those principles that Jesus has said are foundational to our understanding of marriage. And so he begins this next section by saying, "You have heard that it was said," verse 27. He then quotes the seventh commandment, "You shall not commit adultery." Now, just to define what I think we probably all know, but adultery is any sexual immorality involving a married person. The physical union of a man with a woman who is not his spouse is a violation of the one flesh formed by God in marriage. And the Bible never imagines any other relationships but that one flesh relationship. It never imagines that one person can be in multiple simultaneous one flesh relationships. The Bible has no thought that God will take three, four, or more people and join them together into one flesh. It is always exclusively two people, a male and a female, that are joined together by God into that one flesh. And adultery distorts and destroys that God-given union. Now, it can be repaired, but it distorts it and severely defaces it. And the principle that Christ now goes on, or that Christ states as the commandment given to Israel, and ultimately given to every one of us, is that the married are to remain monogamous. That's the only option. Now, we know that physical fidelity is clearly crucial if we're going to have a moral marriage, but faithfulness goes beyond the physical. And that's the point Jesus is making. In the previous section, verses 21 to 26, Jesus has shown that anger and insult deserve the same divine judgment as murder. He now declares that lust deserves the same divine judgment as adultery. And what Jesus says is that lust is adultery of the heart. So the look that longs for another is an adulterous look. The thought which toys with the prospect of another, imagines what it would be like to be with another, or wishes that your spouse would be like another, that is an adulterous thought. So we can summarize it and briefly and say the adulterous heart is not satisfied with the spouse that God has given you. The adulterous heart imagines that satisfaction can be found in an illicit relationship. The adulterous heart takes what should be given to your spouse and gives it to another, even if it is in a fictional digital image, and gives it to another who has no right to it. And Jesus' words here warn us that adultery does not begin with the actions. So adultery does not begin with a call, an inappropriate text, a chance meeting, or a swipe on your phone. An adulterer does not suddenly find himself in the arms of another after being overwhelmed by a notion that he'd never considered before. Adultery starts in the heart. The one that practices immorality has first imagined it, so that the unfaithful act is always preceded by the unfaithful desire. So what Jesus says here, that whoever looks at a woman to lust for her has already committed adultery with her in his heart. The Pharisees should have recognized that lust, in all of its forms, is a violation of God's law. The 10th commandment forbids covetousness, including specifically coveting your neighbor's wife. A desire for someone not your spouse, and to whom you have no right, is that not covetousness? That's exactly what we're talking about here, that the self-righteous ignore the lustful, covetous, idolatrous heart. They imagine that the deed is all that matters, and Jesus will have none of it. He declares the lust deserves the same divine judgment as the act. Now, as you well know, sexual desire is a powerful motivator. The unsaved world certainly knows this. Billions of dollars are spent, and even more billions are made every year targeting lust. Nearly everything the world wants to sell you is presented with some sort of lust-based component. How many scantily clad women pop up on your screen to promote some product? Often a product that has nothing to do with poorly dressed young women. They're using that desire to stir in you a desire for toothpaste or whatever it is they happen to be selling. And our world is filled. It is absolutely inundated with imagery specifically designed to appeal to your lust. And that constant promotion of illegitimate desire is a genuine threat to our obedience to Christ. And just so you know, this is not new. Archaeologists have found ancient cities evidence of pornographic images being used as a marketing tool. So we can't imagine that the lust of this day is some new thing or somehow different than all the previous generation. Now, it might be easier to gratify your lust than it was 100 years ago. But the root of lust has not changed. The problem is still exactly the same. And so to resist the constant temptation of the incessant tawdry displays of the world, you have to remember that the cause of lust is not on the screen in front of you. It's not the people around you. The root of lust is in your heart. And that's where it has to be attacked. And so to do that, Jesus calls for an extreme response to the heart of lust. In the previous section, he told the worshiper to leave his gift at the altar, to go make things right with another person. In later sections, Jesus is going to instruct his followers to let someone slap them again, to let them mistreat them, and even take from them. And the righteousness that Jesus requires demands responses from us that seem unreasonable and sometimes impossible. But the most extreme of this whole section is the one that he prescribes for lust. Jesus says, he calls for amputations, lest you suffer eternal consequences. So the verse 29, Jesus says, if your right eye causes you to sin, pluck it out and cast it from you. In verse 30, he says, if your right hand causes you to sin, cut it off and cast it from you. In both verses, he says, it is better for one of your members to perish than for your whole body to be cast into hell. And now, before you start calling up the hospital to schedule elective amputations, consider just for a second the inability of the deeds of the flesh to purify the heart. We saw this a few weeks ago. Jesus elsewhere taught that unclean food cannot pollute the spiritual heart of a person. If what you eat cannot make you spiritually unclean, you probably ought to think twice before concluding that what you cut off can make you spiritually clean. Now, there have been a few people in history have taken these two verses very literally and physically mutilated themselves in hopes of purifying their hearts. And their testimony is simple. It didn't work. And those who have written about it after the fact have said, it didn't work. I wasn't made righteous. And lopping off body parts will never purify the heart. Amputation has never been an accepted means of spiritual growth. And Jesus prescribes these two radical amputations in the context of heart righteousness. So we need to consider spiritual amputations first before we move on to thinking about physical amputations of any sort. And I think we recognize, you're probably wondering why I'm still talking about it. Because you think, of course it's not literal. We all know he's not talking about literal amputations. But what Jesus is doing is using this very specific kind of figure of speech that uses eye and hand as substitutes for what they do. So that instead of saying, cut off the things your eye sees which fuels lust, Jesus says, pluck out your eye. Instead of saying, cut off the things you do which encourage lust, he says, cut off your hand. In this physical or this figure of speech, the physical body part becomes a stand-in for what that part does. So the offensive eye to be plucked out is the thing that eye looks at, which causes him to sin. The offensive hand to be cut off is the thing that hand does, which draws the person into sin. And Jesus describes both the hand and eye as members. And that same word is used in Colossians chapter 3, verse 5. And there we are commanded to put to death our members which are on the earth. And Paul doesn't say put to death your members which are on the earth, your eyes, your ears, your nose, your tongue, your hand, your feet. He says put to death your members which are on the earth, fornication, uncleanness, passion, evil desire, and covetousness, which is idolatry. All those members are actions and desires. They're not body parts. But Paul calls them, he uses the same word Jesus does, our members. They're not members that can be treated by antibiotics and surgeries, but they are a genuine part of who we are. As we know, we are more than physical beings. We are spiritual creatures with spiritual members. In Colossians, we are told to put those sinful spiritual members to death. And Jesus is talking about that same kind of member. He is warning all who would follow him to do whatever it takes to put away passions and practices which promote or respond with lust. So you pluck out of your life the things you look at which stir or gratify your lust. Now, this is more than cutting off the obvious things like pornography. That should be plain to everyone. It's also cutting off the things which you might not immediately think are troublesome or things that are considered acceptable by many around you. This includes things that may be a problem for you, but are not for someone else. So you may have to pluck out things like movies and magazines and commercials. So if watching the football game stirs lust in you for the cheerleaders, or if watching the soap opera stirs lust in you for the hunky corporate executive, then you need to cut them off. You need to pluck them out. And when, ladies, this does, you talk about lust, I know men get rightly accused of this more than the women, but it applies to all of us. So, ladies, this applies just as much. You cannot fill your mind with thoughts about a perfect lover found in some trashy novel any more than you men can fill your thoughts, your mind with thoughts about the surgically altered women in some movie. It, male or female, we have to set aside every form of lust so that we also cut off the lust-promoting activities in your life. Stop reaching for the remote, the phone, the mouse, the magazine, or the book. So don't cut off your hand, but you absolutely cut off the deeds. Do not assume that because others can participate in something that you should do. Really, you are far better off not knowing anything about current sports, favorite TV shows, viral videos, or what your neighbor on Facebook is doing than you are to feed the furnace of your lust. So recognize the effect that what you see is having on your heart. Recognize the effect that what you do is having on your heart, and cut off every single troublesome deed. Cut off the TV. Turn off the movie. Disable the ads in your computer. Pluck out Friendster and MySpace and Flickr and Instagram and Tumblr and Facebook and Pinterest and Snapchat and whatever other social media thing they have going on nowadays. I know it's always changing. But whatever it is that stirs your desires for what you're seeing on the screen, cut it off. Pluck it out. Cast it from you. And I think we recognize this, but to state the obvious again, it doesn't just apply to digital media. It applies to everything. It applies to books and magazines. It applies to, it could be science fiction. It could be fantasy stories. It could be a mystery story. But that we know that embedded in many of these things are things that are written with the intent to fuel the lust. They're written in such a way to captivate your desire. And when you find that you're reading something that is stirring those lusts, even if it is a so-called Christian romance novel, toss it. Cut it off. And Jesus uses such startling figures of speech to show the extremes to which we must go to maintain purity of heart. Do whatever is necessary, no matter how radical it may seem, to guard your heart against lust. Value righteousness and purity so much that you will do whatever it takes to protect them. Even if somebody calls you a Luddite, you have no idea what's going on in the world around you and have no technology of any sort. That's far better. Far better than breaking these commands. Now quickly, let's look at verse 31 and 32. There Jesus speaks about divorce. And in that, he is not responding to the law of Moses, but to the distortion of the Mosaic law that had become accepted tradition. So the law of Moses did include legislation regarding divorce. And it's worth noting that none of that legislation required divorce, nor did it ever expressly permit it. the legislation assumed it would occur, and actually what it did is placed limits on it. And the portion of the law that Jesus refers to is in Deuteronomy 24. And so he's not quoting Deuteronomy in verse 31, where he says, whoever divorces his wife, let him give her a certificate of divorce. He's quoting, probably quoting the Pharisees and their misuse of Deuteronomy 24. Because Deuteronomy 24 says that if a man divorces his wife, if she marries again, and if that second husband divorces her, then the first husband cannot remarry her. So I think it's the first 4 to 5 verses of Deuteronomy 24 that spell this out. The concern of that portion of the law is to restrict the husband who divorced his wife. It's not to permit divorce, but rather to place some limits. It should have served to prevent frivolous divorces and frivolous remarriages even. But in fact, it was misused by the Pharisees so that what they said is, well, if you want to get a divorce, just give a certificate of divorce. They used it to justify divorce no matter how trivial the reason. And I know I said this at the beginning, but I want to say it again real quick. I don't want to make those of you who have been divorced feel guilty about the things you did before salvation that you had no control over. What I want you to do is consider the present. Are you properly honoring marriage as a holy institution created by God for the benefit of all mankind? No matter what your current marital status is, are you properly honoring the institution of marriage? What the Pharisees did is they misapplied Deuteronomy 24 to give a blanket permission for any divorce, for any reason, as long as you filed the proper paperwork. It was their equivalent of no-fault divorce. And Jesus condemns that tradition. Very definitely, he says, this is what you've heard said, but I say to you, whoever divorces his wife for any reason except sexual immorality. The Pharisees said, yeah, any reason's good. Just file the paperwork. Jesus says, no, any reason is not good. He gives an exception, sexual immorality, but he's not revoking some feature of the law of Moses. He's declaring that the Pharisees' traditions were wrong. Divorce is not permitted for every reason. It's only permitted in one case that Jesus mentions, when one partner is guilty of sexual immorality. Now, in Mark 10, as I read earlier, Jesus taught that marriage was the creation of God and should not be broken by anyone. This is why the words of the traditional marriage vows say for better, for worse, for richer, for poorer, till death do us part. Those words are not just a nice ideal. Nor are they ancient poetry recited to give a wedding a solemn feel. The wedding vows are carefully written applications of the Bible's teaching. God designed marriage to be for life. And in this passage here, Jesus is reaffirming that divine design. He permits divorce when the other partner has acted immorally. That's it. I do need to mention there's one other New Testament passage that describes one other occasion when divorce is permitted. In 1 Corinthians 7, divorce is permitted if an unsaved spouse leaves the saved spouse. Otherwise, marriage is permanent, and only the willful sin of another, which breaks the one flesh relationship, justifies divorce. And I will say, I know there may be other questions that pop up in your mind about that. I'm giving a simple, broad answer to the question of divorce. There are certain cases where that needs to be worked through more carefully. So if you got a big concern about what I just said, talk to me, and we can maybe work through particular situations there. But generally speaking, those two limits, adultery and desertion. Those are the only places where Scripture permits divorce. Jesus then also, verse 32, mentions remarriage after divorce. And remember, this starts with verse 27, thou shalt not commit adultery. It's all about adultery. So the command he is explaining is that command to not commit adultery. The one who lusts commits adultery in the heart. The one who frivolously divorces their spouse, leads their spouse, what Jesus says is it causes her to commit adultery. The one who marries the frivolously divorced commits adultery. So when you step outside of those divine limits that are placed on divorce, then what we find is it's not just another marriage. But what we run into is Jesus says, no, that is adultery because that one flesh union is still present. Just because the law or the tradition or the culture recognizes the divorce as acceptable or legal does not mean God accepts it. So that the ancient and modern practice of no-fault divorce, what Jesus says is it promotes adultery. Our response to that has to be hold tightly to our marriage vows. We need to defend them with our hearts. We need to recognize the problem in marriage in America is not a political problem, it's not a legislation problem, it's not a government's problem, and it's not a media problem. The state of marriage in America is a reflection of the state of the hearts of Americans. And as Christians, that actually gives us a reason to be optimistic about an individual marriage and marriage as an institution. Because we have multiple responses to the heart problems which dishonor marriage. And more wonderfully, we know the one who transforms hearts. And in the process of transforming hearts, transforms relationships. But our responses to all of this section, and first and foremost, should be to maintain a right heart attitude towards marriage. So you who are married, fight for a right heart in your marriage. Keep a right heart with God and a right heart with your spouse. Secondly, whether you're married or unmarried, oppose lust in your own life. Fight against it in all of its forms. Do not submit to it. Do not imagine that the grass is greener on the other side. But rather, if you are married, the grass is greenest in your marriage. If you are single, the grass is greenest in your singleness. Do not believe the lies of Satan that God has placed you in second best and is withholding from you the better. But rather, trust the unfailing goodness of God and be satisfied with where God has you right now. Do not let your desires carry you away into sin. And third, those of you who are married, work hard to have a biblical marriage. Intentionally, diligently work at it. Husbands, love and serve your wives like Christ loved and serves us. And that doesn't happen accidentally. It takes intentional work. Wives, honor and submit to your husbands like Christians are to honor and obey Christ. That, again, doesn't happen accidentally. It takes intentional, careful work. And we must work diligently. You must work together as a spouse to have a distinctly Christian marriage, which shows that marriage is genuinely a beautiful institution, which reflects the gospel and is truly a blessing to all people. And the last thing I would say is preach the gospel. I mean, that sounds like it's kind of a panacea type answer, but it's the answer. Millions of people do not believe marriage is anything more than a convenient social contract because they do not know God. The message of salvation is the most important response that you can give to those who downplay or oppose biblical marriage. It is only when people's hearts are turned to the Lord will they begin to live in obedience to His word. Marriage will not be saved by elections or laws. Divorce can be made more difficult by legislation, but the heart issues will never be addressed by the Congress or the courts. You must address the heart. And it's only the Christians who are going to come up with this notion of addressing the heart. We certainly cannot expect it to come out of Washington or any other capital city. It comes from scriptures. It comes from, and it comes through the faithful Christian who is preaching the gospel and is calling people to submit themselves to Christ and to the word of God. And so address your own heart first. You have to start there. Address your own heart first and then address the hearts of others with the gospel truths of God's word. And in doing so, then we find both the explanation for the beauty and the glory of marriage, and we find hope for marriage.